All right, good morning everybody, and welcome to ITE 2 Module 7. Hope you've all had a good week. Okay, there's only a few on today, but let's start off. We start off with a quiz. we'll do a quiz from last week and just refresh the memory, and then we'll go on to today's lecture, which is all about installing operating systems. Okay, so everybody's got their chat windows open and ready to go. So what are three examples of software that is compliant with the open source initiative? Now, let's do this as a yes-no. That'll be easier, I think. Is BSD Unix compliant with the open source initiative? And the answer is yes, it is.
Anybody else doing it?
I haven't got many. I think Elise is doing things.
I'm trying to track down an email with my friend's TPG login details, although I think I know them anyway, so when I go and set up her router later this afternoon, she will get straight on the net and have a decent network.
Cool. You're talking about TPG. I doubt she'll get straight on the net, but you can dream.
Yeah, tell me about it. Melbourne went off the other night, and I've had some connectivity issues, and not very happy here at the moment. Touch wood. Though she's on ADSL 1, so because I can't get ADSL there, so she should be right.
I don't know. TPG, you get what you pay for. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay. Yes, no. Is GNU Project Software open source initiative compliant with? And yes, it is. What about Internet Explorer web browser? No, that's right. What about Oracle? That's right. And X Windows system. Yeah, I can't fill this lot. That's good. Okay, question two. Which of the following situations is only supported by multi-user operating systems? Is it A, one user switching between multiple programs? B, one user opening and closing several programs? C, two or more users working at the same time? Or D, users working at different times of the day? Yes, we're all awake this morning. That's good. It was C, two or more users working at the same time. Okay, next question. A server system typically requires more of which resources than a client system? Is it A, memory, disk space, monitors? B, disk space, processors, users? C, processors, disk space, and memory? And you are correct. It was C. So it needs more processors, more disk space, and more memory. Okay, which one of the following office tools is available for both Linux and Windows? Is it A, ClarisWorks, B, AppLixWare, C, Lix, or D, StarOffice? Yes, you are correct. It is StarOffice. Next one. What is the preferred security tool for implementing a firewall with Linux 2.4x and later? Is it A, DHCP? Is it B, DNS? Is it C, D, IP tables, or E, SQID? That's good. Yes, it is IP tables. Okay, question six. Where is the security accounts database located in a Windows NT domain? Is it on A, on all authenticating servers? B, on all PDC and BDC computers? C, on the PDC only? Or D, on all Active Directory services? Interesting. Okay, and it was actually C, on the PDC only.
I remember that. Is this on Windows NT?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember them being wrong on that one, because the SAM is actually, there's a read-only copy on every backup domain controller, but don't let HP tell you which way it goes. If the tests ask you, it's B, I think.
Yeah, C. Yeah. Okay, what does the term domain define in a Microsoft server environment? Is it A, a server providing user authentication? This is in your test too. B, a top level in the internet hierarchy. C, an administrative boundary. Or D, an organisational or corporate unit. Guess who's going to get that all correct in their test now, guys? That's good. It was C. Okay, next question. Text editors are essential for performing maintenance tasks. Which four text editors are available in Linux? Just give me a yes, no, that'll be easier. VI. Yeah, that's correct. ITE. That's correct. JED. Yes. Pico. That's correct. SMB. That's correct. And Emacs. Ah, gee.
Geez, they're all good, aren't
they? They're going strong this morning, aren't you? Yeah. Well done. Okay, next question. Which Linux distribution is solely built for non-profit use? Is it A, Debian, B, Mandrake, C, Red Hat, or D, SUSE? Yes, it is. It's Debian. Okay, next one. Which of the following is a French, that is the French, based Linux distribution that uses a GUI installation and RPM?
And has now gone bust. Go on.
Is it A, Debian? Is it B, Mandrake? Is it C, the Red Hat? Or is it D, the SUSE? Or SUSE?
Yes, she just likes that one because she gets to do a dodgy French accent for all the options.
Mais oui!
Sacrebleu! It is a mandrake!
That is the one! Okay, but yes, and you were all correct.
But the only thing I ever learned in French was une glace à la fraise, s'il vous plaît, which I figured would be useful if I wanted a strawberry ice cream.
How was that said?
Une glace à la fraise, s'il vous plaît. A strawberry ice cream, if you please. Oh, bonjour, of course, goes in before that.
Oh, that's good. Okay, all right. Now, to see waking up all these students, questionnaire. Now we get into the lecture. So, as I said, ITE Module 7, and we're talking about software installations and installing operating systems and all that sort of good fun stuff. Okay, so when we're actually looking at installing, oh, and I've just been doing this, I'm having fun installing my new copy of Snow Leopard, which worked well on one of my computers and not so well on the other. Yes, the Snow Leopard operating system is very good though. Nice few changes just for anyone who might be a Mac user out there. Few nice changes in it, and a nice smooth operating system to use. But I digress. So when we're talking about a network operating system installation, we're talking about the process of creating and copying all the operating system files to your hard disk. The system files are the files that they're used by the system, so they allow the operating system to work. Mostly when you're picking up a computer though, you'll find that the operating system has been pre-installed, and you know, obviously for the average user that's the optimum way to be doing it. Once you've got, you know, say for average Joe Blogs, you get your computer, it's got its operating system already on there, and they don't have to do too much at all to tweak it to how they want. And it's optimized, you know, for the configuration of the system that you've got. The advantage, though, of getting, or disadvantage, I guess, of pre-installation is that you're not able to have total control of exact features that you wanted there without a bit of configuring or tweaking.
This can be especially important, especially if you've done a pre-install option and there are certain hots fixes and programs and stuff that you can install onto Windows that cannot be uninstalled. And I think people have steered away from this recently. Most things can be uninstalled, but there are certain bits of gear that once you load them on, for example, certain updates to browser components and stuff are not reversible. So that can be a problem with a pre-installed system. You might have some stuff on there that you don't want.
Absolutely. And I guess the main thing to think about too, when you're thinking about installing an operating system of any kind, is having a plan, doing an inventory first. This is as you're working for someone or doing this for yourself, having an inventory of your system hardware and knowing what works with that hardware, because there's no point in sort of installing something and then finding out it doesn't work with it. So you need to be looking at whether the operating system that you want to install has all or supports the software that you're going to load onto your system. And I guess, as Kerry just mentioned, has become familiar with the operating system and know what may be irreversible that you're loading on or allowing to happen. So all of the operating systems too, the manufacturer sets a minimum hardware standard or minimum hardware requirement for their software, and that sort of focuses mainly around your CPU and the amount of RAM and the amount of disk space, those types of things that you have to think about when you're doing an installation.
That's in your test.
It certainly is. And you'll get lots of questions on there's specific ones on how much RAM and how much CPU you have to have for specific operating systems. So, okay, now you need, as I said, to determine what are the minimum requirements and whether the operating system can support the hardware peripherals that you've got. And that's very important when you're thinking about mission critical peripherals such as, you know, things like your video equipment or storage hardware. So first step is to make a complete hardware inventory, and when you're actually working in a business environment, that will be required, and also it's going to protect your butt a little bit if things go wrong. So
I was going to tell a story. I don't know if anybody remembers, but every time you upgrade from one version of Windows to another, for example, if you go to 95 to 98, 98 to 2000, 2000 to XP, XP to Vista, there's actually a whole subclass of hardware that Microsoft decides they're not supporting anymore. For example, when you went from Windows 98 to Windows XP, there were a whole lot of series of parallel port scanners that no longer worked under Windows XP, no matter what you did. And then when you went from Windows XP to Vista, there are a whole lot of Xerox printers that just didn't function under Vista anymore, and they said, oh yes, driver support in 6 months. And then 5 months into the 6 month deadline, they went, no plans to support these printers under Vista. Thank you, Xerox. So your hardware inventory is very important.
Absolutely. Okay, so as Kerry mentioned, you know, it's absolutely critical that you sort of knowing what's happening and what's not going to happen. So doing that inventory is important. The other thing that the inventory will help you is to determine what applications are actually going to run if you're in a server environment. So whether your organisation, you need to know that, because there could be compatibility issues otherwise. And here we talk too about legacy software, because anyone tell me what legacy software is? You do get asked this in your test too.
I know the answer. Do you, Grace? Legacy.
Okay, Kerry, you go.
Legacy software is software that needs to be run and supported because it provides a feature to an organisation. However, the software is no longer supported or maintained under the latest whiz-bang operating system.
So it doesn't mean that it's just DOS-only software, because like, I thought, like, I wasn't sure that Legacy meant it ran in 16-bit mode.
Well, actually, there's actually 32-bit software that runs under DOS, but let's not go there. For example, there was that thing that you guys don't know this guy, but the thing that Chris wanted to run under Vista that wouldn't run, that was legacy software. And it's any software that doesn't run under the currently running and implemented operating system. And in fact, there are, for example, some programs on the Mac, for example, that were written for Panther and won't run under Tiger or Leopard or Snow Leopard. So they would be defined as legacy software because they do not run under the current release of the operating system. So it's not just DOS for legacy, it's just any software that that is no longer officially maintained and supported. Microsoft does have various compatibility modes that allow legacy software to run under various operating systems, which work to varying degrees of success.
I think that's actually a common misconception that it's only DOS.
I've
heard that before too.
No, legacy software is anything that the manufacturer now considers crusty. That's the way I define it anyway.
Yeah, a little bit like this lecturer. She's a bit of a legacy.
Whenever somebody says legacy, I picture those people running around like getting donations and stuff, you know, for the old people or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing that, as a network administrator, it's very important that if you're going to load any new applications onto a network, is that you're testing those applications before you actually load them on. You won't be very popular if it doesn't work or it causes problems. So you need to sort of really know a little bit about the particular operating system that you're wanting to use before you actually install it.
Can anybody give me an idea of what's one of the programs that companies often use to host legacy software?
A virtual machine.
Well done. Or a virtual environment, yes, because there are virtual machines and there are virtual environments, and you can use those to host your legacy software. So if Geraldine wanted to run WordPerfect on her new 2008 EE PC, we could make that happen.
I used to like WordPerfect. I loved it.
We didn't, because you had all those weird, you know, Control-Alt-F7 or whatever, and there was no menu bar, and each to their own.
I was sighted then, so that made a difference.
You could look at the little template on the top of your keyboard, couldn't you? The little stick-on WordPerfect
yes,
template.
Yeah. Yes. So, yeah, okay, so the administrator, the tips to there is before you actually install, inventory your hardware, look at compatibility issues, make sure all your software applications are supported by the operating system, and become familiar with the operating system and the installation procedure before you install it. Okay, so as I mentioned, plan, and verify before you actually begin the process. Okay, the other thing too, as an administrator, you're going to be looking at is where you're going to install your server. Okay, what sort of environment, plan for that installation. Look at all your power that's available around the area, the connections that you've got, and verify that all your hardware has arrived and all that type of thing. So when we're looking at an installation site, that sounds pretty obvious, but things to look at there is the room, the room where you're going to put it. Okay, now what might be something you'd have to think about in an area where you've got a server going to be installed?
The answer starts with E.
The answer, my friend, is blowing somewhere.
Environmental considerations?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, temperature is one, and humidity. Some of the other thing you might have to look at is some of the elements. You know, is it going to be protected? Where are you going to install it? It's going to be in a floor space, in a rack, or all those type of things, so looking at the environment. Making sure that you've got plenty of airflow around it as well. Okay. Other things to look at would be your power, as I mentioned, making sure that you've got plenty of power sources around there. What might be another good thing to have when you've got a server as regards power?
Lots of fans.
Lots of fans, yeah.
Starts with you.
An interruptible power supply.
Yay! That's it. Yeah, an UPS is a really good idea to have as well. And you need one that's going to be of a proper size to keep your server running for long enough so you can all do a normal shutdown, usually about 5 to 10 minutes.
Has anybody ever seen, and this sort of amazes me, has anybody ever noticed that all of these flash upgrade procedures and stuff go, you should have device XYZ on the AC adapter whilst you are updating the flash, which could take 5 to 10 minutes, and if your device crashes in the middle, you may brick your flash and you may have to return your device to technical support. And nobody ever bothers putting that stuff on an UPS, and they just flash it anyway. It's always sort of mystified me as to why you would sort of play Russian roulette with your device. And that goes with updating things like, Braille lights, Braille notes, M-powers, Packmates, whatever. If they crash in the middle of the flash, you've got to send them back to the technical support center. I suppose if they crash in the flash, they're trashed. That'd be the way I would remember it.
Yes. Okay, so you need to have an UPS that's of a decent size to keep your network up and running, and make sure that when you're upgrading, that you, as Kerry said, make sure it's all plugged into the UPS. Okay, the size of your UPS is actually specified with a VA rating or a volt amp rating. So the larger that rating, the longer the UPS is going to keep your server going. Okay, now the other thing we just touched on was, the temperature in the server room, and your installation plan should actually look at things like the heat output of the devices that are going to be part of your server. And heat load, just as another thing, is measured in British thermal units or BTUs. So you need to have an optimum server temperature.
I think there's actually, if anybody wants to know what a British thermal unit is, you can actually look them up. You can either Wikipedia up BTU or British thermal unit. Because to be honest with you, I don't know what a British thermal unit is, but I know that you've got to have sufficient air conditioning so that the number of units that the air conditioning can handle is higher than the number of units that your server generates. So there you go.
That's right. See, computers like being cool. They definitely like being cool, not too hot. Okay, the other thing you might want to look at too is the speed of your connection. So, you can test that and make sure that you're getting a decent speed out of your server and that all is going hunky-dory there.
Does anybody ever remember, just a sideline here, does anybody remember when you're doing a software install and people used to sort of get their 4-speed or 8-speed CD-ROM or whatever, or even their 24-speed CD-ROM, and they'd install Windows off the CD, and it would take like an hour and a half to copy the files down off the CD onto the hard drive, and then that would just about murder your CD-ROM drive. It also means you should probably make sure that the media and stuff you're installing off is a reasonable speed, and that if you are installing off a network or whatever, that the connection to the network is reliable. You don't want the connection dropping out in the middle of the install. They're usually not too tolerant of that.
Okay, the other thing to bear in mind, and this is where your hardware inventory comes in, is making sure that all your equipment is what you've ordered. Okay, so it's no good getting a server chassis that's a form factor for a rack mount when you've got actually a tower that you want to put it in. So so make sure that you've got the correct equipment. I don't know whether everybody's seen a server rack, but it's we've certainly got one here that our students can see. But it's where your equipment is actually in a upright rack, and it can be moved around fairly easily because generally the rack is on wheels, and so you can actually move that server around, and you can fit everything sort of on top of each other. There's about close to 2 inches, about 1 1/3 inches between each of the units in your rack, so there's still airflow around each of the components. You can also get multiple server racks, and they can be joined together as well. And that way, if you've got a number of servers, you've got a number of racks there as well. The benefit of a rack is that it saves space because everything's sort of going on top of each other. And that includes a lot of the racks. You've got a slide-out shelf that puts in a keyboard and your mouse if you need it. And you can also mount a LCD screen and that type of thing on the rack as well. Okay, another thing to consider is what sort of processors, how many processors you need, and also to look at the number and the type of processors that are available for your server installation. So you've got to make sure that you've got the right ones that you've ordered and verify that, you know, they have the same size of L2 cache as well. Another consideration, obviously, is your memory. Obviously, in a server situation, you're going to need quite a lot of memory, and you know, you've got to make sure that the memory is suitable to the type of install that you're going to do. How many modules or memory modules you can install, what type of memory that you're going to use. And that's very important. Make sure you've got the right memory that's going to fit in the slot that you've got. Okay, other things you look at is the type of disk drives. Obviously, as a server, you're going to want a fair amount of disk space. And you've got to make sure before you start your install too that the disk drives are the correct size, also the type of disk drive as well, whether it's a, you know, IDE, EIDE or SCSIs, and what version of SCSI, whether it's SCSI 1 or 2. So the disk drives, you know, need to be the correct ones that you want. So you'll be verifying their size, also their speed and the type. Other hardware that you're going to need to install, you've got to make sure it's the right one, is the things like your keyboard and your mouse, with what type of monitor you're going to have, you know, whether it's the monitor that's arrived is suitable for if you've got a rack mounted installation, whether it's the correct monitor for that. And it's a good idea to have all this verified before you actually even think about starting your install. We touched on the UPS, also making sure, as I said, that the UPS is the correct type and it's going to support your network. Another thing to think about too is to make sure that you have a backup system, and that system is going to be suitable for the type of server environment. Often types, they are a magnetic type of drive, and the could be a tape drive that's backing up the contents of all your disk drives. The thing to consider there will be the capacity of that drive, so that you've got plenty of capacity to do your backups. And your backups, you know, you can have other devices as well, like your CD devices to do your backups. Okay, the other thing in hardware, looking at whether your cabling is correct for the type of install that you're wanting to do. The different, say for example, the different versions of SCSI are going to use different types of cables, so you've got to make sure that you've got the right cables for the job. Now, with regard to the internal SCSI cables, they are generally a ribbon type cable. And the I'm going to reiterate on this. Pin 1 on that SCSI, on that ribbon cable, is identified by a red strip on the edge of the ribbon cable. That is a red strip on the end of the ribbon cable, identifies pin 1. Okay.
Was that a red strip on the edge of the ribbon cable identifies pin 1, was it?
Yeah, that's so. Exactly right. Yes, yeah, yeah. That's a red strip on the pin one. Yes, that's in your test, guys. With regard to your external SCSI cable, they're generally in a round sort of bundle, and you need to verify that your cables have the correct number of connectors for the type of configuration that you're about to do. Okay, you also need to look at your SCSI adapters, making sure you've got the correct SCSI adapters available, and that you'll note that you have to have the correct number so that you've got enough support for those devices that you want on your network. Okay, you also need to make sure that if the server's going to use a hardware version of RAID, that you have a RAID controller available. It needs to be configured for your network operating system before it can be installed as well. They're usually designed to support a version of your SCSI disk drive, so make sure that your RAID controllers match the bus that your network server has, whether it's an ISA or PCA or PCI 64. If you're going to use a fibre channel attributed loop or FCAL disk systems, you need to verify that you've got the correct fibre channel host bus adapter. Also to make sure that either your fibre optic cable or copper wire is available and that you've got all the correct connections. Other things to think about would be your network interface cards and verifying that all your cards are available and it's that your NIC supports the type of network that you're on. In a network operating system environment, you can have multiple network interface cards as well in your server. Okay, alright, I'm just scrolling down. We're talking about other things you might need there, making sure that you've got all your racks, devices, making sure that you've got all your monitors and CD-ROMs and all of the hardware that you're going to need. Okay, when you're choosing a version of your operating system to install, you need to make sure that, as we mentioned earlier or touched on earlier, that the system hardware meets your minimum requirements of your operating system. So if we're talking in areas of CPU, we're looking at the CPU type or the architecture. We'd also be looking at the speed, which we measure in hertz or megahertz, gigahertz, that type of thing, and also, as I mentioned earlier, the amount of RAM that you've got available. Okay, your minimum system requirements. Now, I will read through these, but I would suggest that you go through and actually read them and learn them because you don't know what. Okay, and I was just saying, when I was rudely interrupted by our teacher there, the minimum system requirements will be in your test. It is in your notes, so please go over it again, but I will sort of talk about as we go along. So for Windows 2000 Advanced Server, the computer and processor requirements are minimum. Optimally, you have more, but this is the minimum. You need a 133 megahertz or higher Pentium compatible CPU, and with Windows 2000, it professional it'll support up to 8 CPUs on any one particular computer. With regard to your memory, you need 256 meg of RAM as a minimum, and 128 meg of supported 8 gig maximum. Your hard disk needs to be 1 gigabyte recommended minimum free hard disk space. You need a CD-ROM, a DVD drive. Obviously, you'll need a display and peripherals that go with that. Now, for Windows XP Professional, you would need a PC with 300 megahertz or higher processor. A clock speed recommended. 233 megahertz minimum required. A single or dual processor with Intel Pentium Celeron family or AMD K6 Athlon Duron family or compatible processor as a recommended. You would need 128 meg of RAM, that's recommended. 64 meg RAM is the minimum supported, and obviously if you only got 64 meg of RAM, you're going to have very poor performance. You would need a minimum of 1.5 gig of free hard disk space, and with Linux, you would need a X8 processor or higher CPU, but it's recommended to have a Pentium class or better CPU. The memory, you'd need 32 meg of RAM as a recommended minimum. Your hard disk would require 300 meg of RAM as your recommended minimum. You would need a CD-ROM drive or very rarely used now, but a 3.5-inch floppy drive. You'd need also your monitor and your peripheral devices. Okay, as I mentioned earlier, you need to do an inventory of all your hardware before you start, and you would, if you needed to, you could open up your case and make sure that you've got all it, and I would do that anyway. Examine all of your slots, make sure you've got all your expansion cards and that type of thing before you actually start your install. With your inventory, you should look at things like your types of devices, the manufacturers, make a model, take all the model numbers down, your device driver version, and also your BIOS revision number. Okay, so make sure you've got all those things before you actually get going. You also need all, as I say, your expansion cards, your making sure that you've got all your devices ready before you actually go. Okay, so just scrolling down to see what we need to... Okay, yeah, all right. You can use your device manager to make sure to check all of the devices that are there, and that's reasonably easy to do, is to open up your device manager, probably the easiest way to get all the information you're going to need. Okay. With regard to Windows 2000, the easiest way to identify if your drivers have been installed or not is to look at the device and see if it has a question mark in a yellow circle next to it. Not so easy for us, I guess, but for sighted people, that's the easiest way to
NVDA
do it.
Will tell you about those.
Yes. Okay, and if that icon's there, it means that the Windows 2000 environment has recognised the device, but if obviously with a question mark, it couldn't find a suitable driver for it. So the device manager gives you then the option to update that driver, and you can tell Windows to search the CD or the internet for the most suitable driver. The other thing you need to do is, after you've done your hardware inventory, to verify that all of your hardware is compatible with your operating system. Now, the easiest way to do that is to check the manufacturer website. The first way is to check the manufacturer website. How would you do that, Kerry?
The first way would be to check the manufacturer website using the internet.
Yeah, exactly. We've got a bit of delay here at the moment. What's your ping?
I'll have a look and then I'll stop the web server.
Okay. Yeah, we're getting a little bit of delay. Okay, so yeah, look up for your manufacturer website for checking your hardware compatibility list there. In your notes, you've got all the websites listed for different operating systems, so if you need to find them, that's the easiest, quickest way to do it. Also, the other thing you're going to have to look at is verifying your network, looking at the configuration of the network. Most of your network servers are going to use either the TCP/IP protocol or the IPX/SPX protocol, or they may use both indeed. Okay, when you're configuring TCP/IP, you would need to have things available like your IP address, your subnet mask, your gateway address, your default gateway, and the IP address of your server or the DNS server. Okay, now if you're wanting to find out that information, if you're on a Windows server, you would use the ipconfig command. And if you were on Unix or Linux, you would use ifconfig. That will verify your connectivity. To test your connectivity further than that, using TCP/IP, you can use, as what I just asked Kerry, the ping command to look at the ping to see if you're actually getting network connectivity. The best IP address to ping is the IP address of your default gateway, and it should return you a ping if your system is properly configured. And that's a good way to troubleshoot your network connections. Okay, the next thing is to test your boot processes. So the boot process of Windows 2000 is actually different from Windows 9X. The one with 9X is actually simpler. But in both 9X and in Windows 2000, you've got completely different files that are used to start your operating system. With 9X, there's a fewer amount, but when they boot, they load up your startup programs and check for drivers. With 2000, it's a lot more involved. There's a few more steps involved, and there's a number of extra things that it's looking for, things like more security features and logon features. So with Windows 2000, it goes through a series of steps as it boots up your computer. And it's good to have a good idea of what sequences it goes through. So in Windows 2000, you've got the pre-boot sequence, the boot sequence, the kernel load, then the kernel initializes, and then it comes up to the logon. Okay, so that's very important to remember those processes, the pre-boot, the boot, the kernel loading and the initialization, and then your logon processes. Okay. Now, I can't hear you, Kerry. Oh, sorry. Go on. Okay.
Just resynchronizing our pings down to 19, and if you're transmitting, the lag stays there, but once you stop transmitting, it'll reset the lag, so you shouldn't be lagged as much now.
Thank you. Okay, so before we actually go more into the boot process, we'll have a look at the files that you need to have a successful boot and where they're located. So if you're looking at the boot process in an Intel or a non-Intel based system, they can be they're a bit different because the NTLDR file isn't needed in that case. And in those systems, you'd have a file called osloader.exe that performs the same function. Also, the ntdetect.com file is not needed on non-Intel-based systems. Okay, alright, so your necessary boot files is the NTLDR, and that's the root of the active partition, which is your C:\. The boot ini, again in that root of the active partition, the bootsec.docs, and that's only if you're dual booting, the ntdetect.com, which is also in that root directory, the ntbootdd.sys, which is also in that root directory. And then there's a whole lot of others, and you're not going to remember all these, but you can go back and have a look in your notes. The NT boot dd.sys, I just said that, which is in the root of the active partition. The ntoskrnl.exe is in your C: winT system32, as is the hal.dll. The system registry key, which is in the C winT system32 / config, and the device drivers, which are in the winT system32 / drivers. Okay, with your boot process, it can't function without the BIOS. Now, anyone tell me what BIOS stands for off the top of their head?
Basic Input Output System.
Ah, that's correct. So, basically the instructions and data that's in the ROM chip controls your boot processes, and the computer hardware is referred to as the BIOS. So it's the basic input and output system of the computer. So when you're actually booting up your computer, what happens is the BIOS performs a number of interactions with your system hardware. So it looks and checks that the necessary hardware is present and that it's operating correctly. And it does that during what we refer to as the power on self test, or POST. So during POST, the computer tests the memory. It looks and verifies that it's got all the necessary hardware. And then it uses that information is actually utilized by the BIOS, and that controls all of the aspects of your booting process. Now, if you get a problem during the POST, the BIOS produces audio and video error codes. So it gives the or provides the computer with the basic instructions to allow it to control all the devices in the boot processes. So the BIOS locates any BIOS codes on your on all of your expansion cards, and it executes them during that boot process. And it locates a volume or boot sector on the drive and allows the drive to start the operating system. So I'm going to go through this process in detail because it's very important that you understand it. So you've just turned the computer on. What happens next is the boot process starts and post through post. And after the computer then completes post, it allows all the adapter cards to run their own post. All of your things like your SCSI cards and that sort of thing, because they've got equipped with their own BIOS. After POST is complete, the computer locates a boot device and loads the master boot record, or the MBR, into its memory. It then locates the active partition and loads that to memory, and allows the operating system to load into RAM, or random access memory. Alright, so up to that point, your computer's been, you know, churning along, and it's paid, done its tests, and it's now looked for all of the functioning hardware, and hopefully your operating system is going to load. At that point, the computer loads and initializes the NTLDR file. And what that file is actually the system loader. So it begins to load the operating system. So once the computer has loaded NTLDR, the boot sequence begins to get further information about all of the drivers and hardware. So the NTLDR uses the ntdetect.com, the bootini, and the bootsec.dos files. The bootsec.dos file, just to mention there, is only going to be used if you've got the computer set up to dual boot. So what the NTLDR, its major function is actually switching the processor to a 32-bit flat memory mode. So up until that point, the computer was actually running in real mode. And so after that, NTLDR starts your file system. Now, that file system could be either a FAT32 or NTFS or so on. Now, what it does is it reads the boot ini file and enables the display of the boot menu on the screen. And that's where you are able to select, you know, which operating system you want to load if you've got a dual booting system. Now, if, say, for example, you've selected Windows 2000 and the computer's not dual booting, it'll look for the ntdetect.com file, and it'll gather information, again, about your hardware. And it's also at that step that you can use F8 if you want to troubleshoot. Now, that may be different on other computers, but yeah, it's usually F8. Okay, all right. The next step that will happen is that the kernel load phase begins. So you've got the ntoskrnl.exe file loading at that stage, and but your NTLDR will still be playing a part in your boot processor, because at that stage what it's doing is it's reading the system registry key and selecting the hardware configuration that's stored in the registry. All right, you can also at that point of the boot process select which hardware profile you want to be loaded if you've got more than one profile. Okay, and at that step, after it's done all those registry tests, the kernel files will have been loaded into memory. What happens next is the kernel is initialized. So the what I mean by that is it's recognized that everything's been loaded, and that NTLTR can now give the control over to the operating system kernel. And it can be that's when you get the final stages of the operating system loading. At that stage, you'll get your GUI appearing and status bars to say that all is hunky-dory. Okay. All right, so once your kernel has completed the initialization process, it then uses all the information that it's got to detect all your hardware at that stage, and it creates the registry key, which would be, in that case, hkey_local_machine/hardware file. And that's got all your information about the hardware that's located on your computer. Okay, what happens next is the kernel references the registry subkey and then creates a clone. What I mean by a clone is a copy of the current control set that value that's in the registry. The computer then uses that clone to maintain a copy of, well, it's an identical copy, hence a clone, of the data that you've got configured on the computer. So that registry value wouldn't reflect the changes that you've got, though, in the startup process. Next, the device drivers are loaded and they're initialized. And the drivers indicate at what point in the process that the driver is going to load, and that's the same for the device driver value in the kernel load phase as well. And the next final step is your where you have all your services started, and what happens there is something that's called the session manager, and that is started when the SMSS.exe file is loaded. And it, what that session manager is responsible for is loading the programs that are in the boot execute registry entry. Okay.
An interesting point that a lot of people don't realise is that when the login screen shows up under Windows NT and Windows XP, it's actually still loading services in the background. And if you're one of these people who either doesn't set a password on your computer at all because you really can't be bothered typing one in, and you never want to remember your network passwords, or you are a user that just wants the computer to log straight in because that's the way you want it to happen, it can actually be slower that way than if you actually wait 10, 20 seconds after the login prompt. But of course we are all impatient, and that's why everybody complains about the computer slowing down when you first log in, because it is actually still loading up all of the other services such as your volume control managers, your AI gear, your hybrid power engine if you're running an EEPC, all of that sort of thing. So yeah, just an interesting side point there, that just because the login prompt is up does not mean all of your services have yet started in the background.
No, and in actual fact, if you what's the name of that program that we've got on ours, Kerry, that gives you all the sounds?
Andre Lewis, the sound scheme, yeah.
Yeah, that's really good for everybody, because you actually hear that the processes are still going on, and it's very useful because you can wait till it's nice and quiet then and know that everything's up and running without sort of overloading your computer at that stage trying to do things when you shouldn't be.
Interestingly enough, and one of the things you'll notice too is that sighted people often log in before JAWS starts, because they can actually see the login prompt and they know it's time to log in, but JAWS doesn't start until somewhat later, because you can't actually start JAWS until the network services are all running, which means that you need to wait for all of them to start before JAWS will launch, which is why it's set low in the service load order. Of course, if you were to start JAWS before the network services were started, you wouldn't actually get your ILM network authorization to function, which is why they put that restriction in there.
I find with the Andre Lewis sound scheme that it's a little too verbose for my taste, so...
Turn off the unused sound events you don't want to hear. Simple. If you don't like the arrow moving sounds, switch them off. If you don't want the question mark sounds, switch them off. But the process launch and die sounds are very handy, especially if you've launched something and you're not actually sure whether it's launched. If you've got no vocal feedback, you can actually have the ticks and the plunks enabled and everything else turned off, and that way it doesn't overload you too much. I find it very handy to know whether Internet Explorer has opened a new tab, because if you've got some very busy web pages, sometimes JAWS won't let you know that a new tab has actually opened up.
Yeah, I really like it, actually. Yeah. Okay, so you log in, as we're talking about log on screens, that's obviously the beginning of your final step in your boot up process. Once you've logged on, the clone of your current control set value is copied to the last known good control set value in the registry. And that's just a safety measure that the operating system performs so that you can actually reboot your computer if you've got a problem. Okay. All right. I'm sorry, I'm just scrolling down, scrolling.
There is actually one question in the final exam that asks you to order those boot sequence steps, so just be aware of that. You need to know the basic order of those steps, otherwise you'll get that question wrong.
You do.
And yes, that is in all the Microsoft exams, so it's not just HP being nasty. The boot sequence is all very boring and really unimportant until one day it doesn't work, and then you wish you knew how it did work so you could fix it.
Then you wish you knew it, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And also there's a lot of sort of, you know, using the... a lot of taking in this actual module as well. Lots of, you know, H key, local machine, all this. Actually, you get questions on that in your final too. So it is important to know it. Okay. You have been warned. Okay. If you've got problems during your installation, you may have things like partitioning or formatting, you know, things or system hangs, it's important to know where to look for information about what's happening. Checking your pages in the BIOS has got a lot of that information, and it'll tell you all about the drives and allow you to test to see, you know, if, for example, your system's recognising the disk and that sort of thing. Now, there's no feedback verbally from JAWS in when you're in the BIOS, so you will need sighted assistance when you're going in there. I just mentioned
that. You're really brave, a can of fear eater.
Some BIOSes are actually GUI, and that won't work. There are actually some BIOSes where you must use the mouse, so just be aware of that too.
Mm.
Disturbing trend, actually, that they brought out a whole stack of GUI BIOSes. I think they ended up backing that out, but because a lot of people didn't like it so much, but there were actually BIOSes that came up and they looked like Windows. And whilst you could read the text, you had no way of knowing where the mouse pointer was. And no, the arrow keys didn't work on some of them, which was a bit disturbing.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing you can do, according to Christian, is if you've got a Braille embosser and a print screen button, you can print out the BIOS screens and figure out where you are.
Ah, yeah, that's a good idea, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so there's been a lot of fairly deep sort of stuff in today's lesson. But, yeah, have a read back through your notes. There is more information than what I've given you, obviously. But, yeah, it's very important to understand specifically that boot process and how to do your inventory, all that sort of thing. Now, I'm not going to do a quiz today because we have not many on. But I will, I'll forewarn you, I will do a Module 7 quiz before we start Module 8 next week. So I haven't had a look at this stage and what's in Module 8, but I'll have a quick look while I'm talking. But is there any questions? I know we've got Suprita on, and thank you for bearing with us, Suprita. Have you got any questions, or has Grace got any questions you'd like to ask us?
No, but I'll definitely be reading my notes.
I don't think a lot of our students are even up to ITU2 yet, to be honest. We won't let those people identify themselves. But I don't think anybody's quite got through all of the work in ITU1 and Discovery1 yet.
Okay, next week we're going to be talking more about installations and specifically about Windows 2000 Server, okay, and how to manage accounts and services and all that type of thing. So, all right, well, without any further ado, if no one's got any questions, we'll end it there. So thank you for bearing with us, and we'll talk to you next Wednesday, and we'll be around on Skype. So.